Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. This is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. With me today, as always, are Bob Novella.
Hello, everyone.
Perry DeAngelis.
Good evening, all.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
Guys, thanks again for joining me on The Skeptic's Guide.
I wouldn't be anywhere else.
This is a small milestone. This is our 20th episode. Our number 20.
Only 330 more to catch The Simpsons.
Is that right? Yeah. we are well on our way.
How many podcasts make a season?
Well, 22 is the standard for sitcoms.
22.
Of course, HBO, it's 13.
I guess we get to define that. This is new territory. We get to define it.
I think 10.
Well, let's say 20.
So we're concluding our second season.
All right. That's good. Second season.
Okay. Well, fine.
Season two.
In a few minutes, we have a guest that will be joining us tonight, Tom Clark, founder of Naturalism.org. But first, we're going to just talk about a couple of news items. So a couple of quick updates on our favorite topic, intelligent design. It's been so active, you know, culturally in the news recently. It's obviously a very important topic for us as scientists and skeptics that we can't help talking about it. Two news items caught my eye this week. The first is a story about a new course being taught at the University of Kansas. Now, if you recall, it's the Kansas State School Board, which a few years ago voted to remove evolution from the state's science standards for their public schools. The board who made that vote was largely voted out. The new board reversed that decision, but then just 2 years later in 2003, another, you know, more conservative board was put back in, and now they're at it again. This time, not trying to remove evolution from the standards, but to insert specific language which is skeptical of or critical of evolution in the standards of the state. The University of Kansas apparently is embarrassed by all of this. They of course are interested in maintaining the academic credibility of their institution.
Too late.
It's an uphill battle. There's a new course being taught in the Department of Religious Studies called Special Topics in Religion, Intelligent Design, Creationism, and Other Religious Mythologies. This is being taught, again, not in the science class or not in the science department, but in the religious studies department. The chairman of that department, Paul Marecki, is quoted by the Associated Press as saying that the KU, Kansas University faculty, has had enough. Creationism is mythology. Intelligent design is mythology. It's not science. They try to make it sound like science. It clearly is not. So the academics at the university there are getting quite upset that their state is being, you know, embarrassed in front of the world over and over again by, you know, the creationists who are infiltrating their school board. So they're gonna draw a line in the sand. And
good, they're gonna battle them.
Good for them. Absolutely.
Very good.
Imagine how disgusted they must be. You know, if we worked there, how we would feel to be associated with that.
I'm disgusted from here. Imagine how they must feel being in Kansas.
Exactly, my point.
I mean, you know, it's in the same country. I'm embarrassed that it's the same species as me. Forget about the same state,
yeah, right?
It's just horrible.
It seems almost overdue to me.
It's a little overdue.
Thank goodness.
Well, I think the scientific community is searching for ways to support evolution and oppose intelligent design. You know, although the one pitfall of this is that it can be misinterpreted as quote unquote circling the wagons. The intelligent design proponents have gotten a lot of rhetorical, you know, debating advantage out of the notion that, you know, scientists are defending evolution as a dogma. And this sort of circling of the wagons sort of plays into that. But the point has to be made that, you know, greater than 98% of scientists believe in evolution supported as an established scientific fact because of the overwhelming evidence, not because it's mandated or it's some kind of a dogma.
Right.
Well, thank goodness we have a good media out there explaining all this to the lay public, right? Oh, right. Whoops.
Yeah. Well, you know, the media at least does a reasonable job, I found, on this issue. I mean, a lot of overtly paranormal issues, I don't think they take as seriously. But, you know, this is public school science education. There's at least a little bit of seriousness in it. And the scientists that I hear being quoted are doing a decent job. So I haven't been appalled by how the press is dealing with this issue.
Well, that's good. I mean, but the press is certainly thriving on the controversy.
Sure.
It makes for good headlines. I've never seen as many headlines as ever regarding this long debate as there is now. That mm-hmm. probably also has to do with sort of a conservative swing, maybe since 2001, that's been occurring in the country,
mm-hmm.
and maybe why there is this swelling again of ID creationism and putting it sort of back towards the front pages of newspapers and headlines on national news programs. A lot of people are talking about it that weren't talking about it, you know, five, 10 years ago.
And you wonder if ultimately that would be to our advantage or disadvantage. Typically, historically, the more public and loud this debate gets, the better the creationists tend to do. Evolution tends to win its victories, you know, in the courtroom, in areas where there are rules of evidence and logic, not in the courtroom of public opinion, at least not in this country. But we will see. One, just to give you the reply of the ID side, John Calvert, who is an attorney managing director of the Intelligent Design Network, said that Marecki, the department chair who made the comments I quoted earlier, will go down in history as a laughingstock. He said, to equate intelligent design to mythology is really an absurdity, and it's just another example of labeling anybody who proposes intelligent design to be simply a religious nut. That's the reason for this little charade.
Okay.
You know, that is simply absurd in and of itself. I mean, again, the reason why intelligent design is being criticized is because it is not science.
Perhaps we need to invite him on and explain that to him.
Absolutely.
And
Perry,
to our listening
work on that.
Audience.
John Calvert, let's get him on.
I'm sure he'll come on.
I would love to get an ID proponent on this show and have a discussion with him. I think that we would have a good
Sooner
time.
Sooner or later, we probably will. We'll work on it.
We will work on that. Quickly, just the other news item that caught my eye is about the Vatican. Now, we've been sort of following with interest what the Catholic Church has to say about the intelligent design debate, mainly for historical reasons. You know, the Catholic Church had its famous disagreement with Galileo, and in, I believe it was in the 1980s, the last pope unexcommunicated Galileo and basically said that it was wrong to, you know, persecute him.
Scusi, mille regretti.
Scusi. And this is Pope John Paul II also endorsed evolution as essentially, you know, more than just a theory, as a proven, you know, scientific fact and not incompatible with the Catholic faith, which was welcome. We're all sort of watching out of, you know, mainly historical interest to see where the new pope is going to fall on this. So far, he has not offered anything up definitive or concrete. He did make a comment a couple of weeks ago that the world, this is Pope Benedict XVI we're talking about, made something to the effect that the universe was made by a quote-unquote intelligent project. So, yeah, that word intelligent is in there.
Ooh.
That immediately brings up the specter of intelligent design. But last week, the Vatican chief astronomer said that intelligent design isn't science and doesn't belong in science classrooms. That was the latest high-ranking Roman Catholic pronouncement on the subject. So this is not the Pope himself, but the chief astronomer, who is, say, it's the Reverend George Coyne, who is a Jesuit. The Jesuits, you know, within the Catholic Church, have a reputation for being very intellectual and very scholarly, so it's not a surprise that he's a Jesuit. So anyway, we'll continue to follow that, too. I think this just all the aspects of the public debate about intelligent design and creationism have tremendous implications for the role of science in our society, the role of science education, the very definition of science. It is an epic debate, almost, taking place in our culture today on this issue. And, of course...
And it's not going to end for a long time.
No, I don't think so. But and I think
that... It would
be
nice if we could win in the court of public opinion, however.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we've been consistently winning in the courtroom. And, of course, this is one of the primary reasons for this podcast, for the New England Skeptical Society to exist, is to educate the public and to win the fight of public opinion.
Is victories just won in the courtroom are simply never as impactful or lasting or as you know things won by the vote or by public opinion.
I don't know. I don't know about that.
I think that's why we're still arguing about abortion.
Perhaps. But you know,
it was wrought in the courts. You know, people can't vote on it, and when you let people vote on things, then the argument dies down. People accept the outcome of votes. People will always argue about the outcome of courts.
It's true, but of course, you know, today in this country, we certainly don't want to decide this issue by vote. Some things are not properly decided by votes.
Right.
Scientific conclusions are not a matter of democracy. Scientific conclusions follow logic and evidence, not public choice or public opinion.
It would be nice to have public opinion on our side.
It would. Well, we'll keep chugging away, you know, chipping away at this as much as we can. Well, let's move on to our guest. All right, so joining us now is Thomas W. Clark. Tom Clark is the founder of Naturalism.org, the founder and editor, and also the director and founder of the Center for Naturalism. Tom, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Well, many thanks for having me, Steve. It's really good to be with you, and congratulations on your, I guess it's your 20th show.
Yes, as we were just talking briefly before, that this is our, in fact, the 20th episode of the Skeptic's Guide.
Yeah.
So congratulations, everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Yay.
So, you know, Tom has lectured for the New England Skeptical Society in the past, which is how we first met, and a lot of very interesting topics that you cover in the numerous articles that you've written. But why don't we just start, why don't you just give us a definition of scientific naturalism? What is at the core of this philosophy that you're promoting?
Well, really, naturalism, as the center presents it, as you say, it's a scientific naturalism, and we call it scientific mostly because we take science, or more broadly speaking, empiricism, as our way of knowing about the world. At least that's the cognitive commitment we make. And what that commitment does, because science tends to unify the phenomena that it describes, whatever science takes to exist, it holds to be in relation to everything else that it takes to exist. What science does, it unifies what exists into a single natural world, what we call nature. So if you make that commitment to science, or more broadly speaking, empiricism, an evidence-based way of knowing about things, then you'll be led to naturalism, which is simply the view that there's a single natural unified world of phenomena that science describes ultimately, and is not in addition to that, there isn't a supernatural realm. So this is naturalism in its bare bones, simply contrasted with supernaturalism, which supposes that there are two different sorts of things, and you get to supernaturalism by supposing that the way you justify at least certain sorts of beliefs is not via empiricism or science, but by faith or tradition or intuition, revelation, that kind of thing.
Okay.
So that's naturalism just in a thumbnail.
Seems very compatible with skepticism.
Well, yeah. I mean, skeptics are usually skeptical on the same basis that scientists are operate. Namely, they want to be shown. They want good evidence. Skeptics won't believe simply on the basis of what they're told, unless it comes from a very good authority that you know on good evidence is a good authority. So that, you're absolutely right. Skepticism has a lot in common with the science-based commitment that naturalists take. So, but what I've discovered, though, that there are many skeptics, although when I spoke to the NESS down in Connecticut, actually, it was a very, I would call it, enlightened audience, because they were properly skeptical about the one thing that I find most people aren't that skeptical about. They take on faith really the idea, even many skeptics, the idea that people have a certain kind of what I would call a supernatural freedom from causality. There's a widespread notion in this culture that we have a kind of free will that makes us sort of causal exceptions to nature, and that people somehow evade causality. But if you're a good skeptic and if you're a good naturalist, you'll question that assumption, which I think is at the heart of our culture. So that's where what the center is trying to do, among other things, is to sort of extend naturalism into this next realm, which is to question free will as it's commonly conceived. Mm-hmm. So that's where I hope in the center's work to make progress in not only denying God, which skeptics, of course, are, and the paranormal, and the spirits, ghosts, angels, devils, that kind of thing, but also to question this fundamental assumption that we have about ourselves. Mm-hmm. But to do it in the context of a positive worldview, namely naturalism.
Well, you know, you bring up a lot of topics I'd like to touch on just in what you've said so far. But you know, before we go on, move on to the topic of free will, just to get back to just some of the fundamentals about naturalism. So I was interested in that you said that it begins with a commitment to scientific naturalism. It's the idea that all that there is what there is in nature. Does it have to start with that, or do you think that you can arrive at scientific naturalism from more fundamental, you know, philosophical first principles?
Well, that's what I see the epistemological commitment as being, the way we know about things. That's really where, where a worldview starts, is how do you justify your beliefs? How do you justify your knowledge claims? And so that, I think, is probably a fundamental assumption as you can make in terms of a philosophical principle or a cognitive principle. So that, that's I think bedrock, because when you talk to people about, well, how do you know what you know, mm-hmm. then they're going to cite some sort of either authority or evidence or intuition or feeling or tradition. And when you ask them on what further basis, for instance, on what further basis do we place our bets with evidence? Well, we can cite certain reasons, but ultimately we make that commitment. I mean, I can give you ideas, some reasons as to why we should be empiricists, but ultimately there's no logical compelling reason I can adduce to make someone be an empiricist like myself.
Right.
So I think that's, you know, your epistemology is really where it all starts. And of course you can attempt to justify your epistemology, for mm-hmm. instance, empiricism versus faith. But if someone isn't already on board with it, it's pretty tough to convince them to come over to your side.
I definitely agree that if your basic approach to knowledge and to your worldview is based upon faith versus based upon empiricism or science, it's going to be difficult to breach that gap. But I mean, I would formulate it slightly differently, and this is a debate that I've had with a lot of philosophers within the skeptical movement in terms of, you know, does scientific skepticism require a philosophical commitment to naturalism? And I think that although, you know, most of us are naturalists, I would say that it's not absolutely necessary, but rather there's a recognition that naturalism is a necessary component of scientific skepticism, of science itself. So in other words, you don't necessarily have to say that, all right, I'm going to choose to believe that all there is the natural world and there is nothing supernatural, because I respect empiricism as a means of knowledge and of understanding nature. You could say, or what I would say, is that empiricism and working within a naturalistic framework is the only way to have any knowledge about nature, because it's the only way that science can function. And therefore, it doesn't necessarily discount a supernatural world. It just says that we can't know about it because there's no, it's inaccessible. It's outside the realm of science because it does not fall. There's no way for science to address it. Does that make sense?
Well, I more or less agree. But here's I would alter what you said somewhat in that I think that science, as it's practiced, doesn't need the supernatural-natural distinction at all. Some people, when talking about the scientific method, talk about methodological naturalism, which I think is kind of a mistake because that misleads people into supposing that science assumes some idea about what's natural in advance. When in fact, what I think happens is science has a set of explanatory criteria of explanatory adequacy. And it, of course, things have to be falsifiable.
Right.
They're criteria of the scientific method that say nothing about the supernatural natural distinction. What happens though is if you apply the scientific method in justifying beliefs in say entities or processes or phenomena, whatever they are, then those phenomena of course constitute that ends up being what we call nature.
Right.
So I think science precedes naturalism, and it precedes the natural supernatural distinction. After all, if you look at the history of science, our very conception of nature has been driven by what science has revealed to be the case. So when people say that science can only deal in natural phenomena, I think in a way that's even a little bit misleading. It deals in natural phenomena insofar as what's been called natural is what science has previously discovered. So I think science.
Right, you think it's a tautology that basically we define what is natural based upon what scientific methodologies can know.
Right, and the scientific methodology doesn't assume anything in advance about what's real.
Yeah, but I agree with that. I agree with that. But it is a methodological statement though. So
yes.
I mean, it kind of is just a matter of definition, but it's an important one. It's actually. Very relevant. It's at the center of the intelligent design debate that's going on right now because a lot of the intelligent design proponents are saying that, well, scientists have rigged the game against quote-unquote supernatural explanations by requiring an a priori commitment to naturalism as an assumption of the scientific approach or scientific
method. And that's false.
And you're coming at it from a different angle than I've heard before, but it makes perfect sense. Like, well, the supernatural and natural distinction is false.
It's generated by science.
Right.
So what,
but I mean, it's not, there's no a priori assumptions that we have about what is natural and what is supernatural.
Right.
Natural is by definition what can be studied scientifically.
Exactly.
And if something is not, and if you can't formulate something in a scientific way, then it's outside the realm of science. If you want to call that supernatural, that's okay.
Yeah.
So I think we are talking about the same thing. I think we're just approaching it from different angles.
Right.
Because I think I agree, it's very important not to say that science has an assumption of naturalism. It's just
right.
that naturalism is defined by the scientific method itself.
That's right. It's defined by the method in that you make the commitment to science as your sole epistemology. You remain content with science. You don't seek. You don't need anything more. You're tough-minded, as we might put it, about that. But I think this is an important point because it cuts off the wedge strategy of intelligent design right at the root. It shows that these guys have no case at all against science insofar as they think or claim that it assumes naturalism. Science does not assume naturalism at all.
It is naturalism, in a way.
Well, it leads to naturalism
as
a worldview. Science itself is not a worldview. It's a way of knowing, and your worldview, your ontological commitment about what exists ultimately, that's a worldview, and that's what naturalism is. So when you teach science, you're not teaching naturalism. You're teaching a way of knowing, and kids in school are not being compelled to stick with science alone in coming up with a worldview.
Well, that's the other thing. They are independent of each other. You can be, you know, a scientist with respect to claims about the natural world that are theoretically knowable, and then, you know, there are some claims which are outside the realm of science because they are not falsifiable, they're not amenable to scientific investigation, even in principle.
Right.
Now, if you have a commitment to, you know, if your philosophy, your epistemology is you know, is naturalism, you would say, well, those are outside the realm of science, therefore they're unknowable. And, you know, what I would say is that the philosophically logical position to take towards that is agnosticism, saying, well, those things are just unknowable, and that's the beginning and the end of my belief about them. They're unknowable, and well, any belief about them is an arbitrary personal choice of belief, and or i.e. faith. And faith isn't necessarily incompatible with science; it's just completely outside the realm of science.
Right. I think agnosticism, for my money, is a little bit too wishy-washy, because after all, when we might say, yes, we don't know whether something exists, and sort of reserve judgment about it.
It's not a reserve judgment. It's just I'm going to use it in the way that, you know, T.H. Huxley invented the word agnosticism.
Mm-hmm.
He had a very specific meaning in mind when he did so, and that's the meaning that I'm going with. It's not that I reserve judgment. It's that it's inherently unknowable. And therefore, any belief, positive or negative, about it is arbitrary. The only thing that you can scientifically say about it is it's unknowable. And that's where the scientific view begins and ends.
Right, but what I would also add to that, if something is unknowable, there's no reason to believe in it. It exists.
That's correct.
So in that sense, I'm an atheist. I have no good reason to believe that in the existence of God. Therefore, as far as I'm concerned, God doesn't exist. So I am an atheist based on science and naturalism, not merely an agnostic.
I agree with that, and what I'm just saying, I do not think is incompatible with that.
Yeah.
And you're basically just saying, I'm choosing not to have any arbitrary beliefs, and therefore that's
right.
Atheism. But I think it flows from the position of agnosticism, which is basically just recognizing it as unknowable, and saying that from a scientific point of view, you know, epistemological point of view, that's really what's most important.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And I think you could be an agnostic and an atheist at the same time, basically, because
yeah.
One's really agnosticism is really a philosophical position, whereas atheism is saying is that plus the value judgment of, you know, arbitrary beliefs about things that are unknowable or of no value, I choose to, you know, work within the realm of naturalism. Right?
Yeah,
would you agree with that?
Yeah. Why inflate your ontology?
Right.
that's really the key, is you don't add unnecessary, it's sort of Occam's razor applied to beliefs.
Right.
Why even reserve the doubt, the possibility of something existing, unless there's at least a modicum of evidence in its favor? Otherwise, just rule it out. And it doesn't mean you won't revise your beliefs later in the light of future knowledge. But otherwise, you don't want your ontology to get cluttered up with possible entities just because you don't know enough about them to decide the question of whether they exist. That's all I'm saying.
Right, though I still think that's a little bit different than what I was saying, because it's not knowing
it might
enough.
Be.
They're inherently unknowable. There's no possible information you can have in the future that would change that. It's by the very construction of the question, you're hypothesizing something which is, for example, outside the natural laws of the universe by definition, therefore, you know, there's no possible future observation or experiment or knowledge you can have which would even address the question.
Yeah.
I'll use intelligent design as an example of a hypothesis that's logically constructed to be unfalsifiable.
Mm-hmm.
Their concept of the designer is unfalsifiable for the following reason. Because it's unconstrained. They basically say, and I've cornered, you know, more than one intelligent design defendant with this, that you can't make any statements about what a designed, you know, biological world would look like, because that presupposes information about the designer and sort of restricts or puts restrictions on the designer, which they say is not acceptable. But in that case, then whatever the world looks like, whatever observation you make, is therefore consistent with that designer. You cannot ask any questions about what the world should or should not look like. It could, in fact, look exactly like a world that evolved over billions of years, if that's what the designer chose to make it look like.
Sure.
So that's unfalsifiable. You know, it's not. You can't prove it wrong through science. All you can say is that it's not science, and therefore should play no part in scientific discussion.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, I was at a conference at Boston University called The Great Debate, in which the intelligent design folks were on one side of the debate,
mm-hmm.
and the skeptics and the scientists from the other. And it's often been said that people on our side, naturalists and skeptics, should never debate the intelligent design folks because of a sympathetic audience will always make it come out against us. This was just the opposite. It was very satisfying. The intelligent design folks got thoroughly stomped.
Who was on our side? Was Kenneth Miller there or somebody with experience?
Eugenie Scott was there.
Yeah, she was. She's terrific.
Good. All right.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think of who else was there, if I can find the flyer. But they did a terrific job. Oh, here we go. On our side were Eugenie Scott, James Trefill, I don't know if you know him, George Mason University, and a student. And then on the pro-ID side was, of course, William Densky.
Yeah.
And his being his typical self, but they simply got slammed.
That's great.
And of course the audience was very much on our side, so it was quite satisfying. So it's sort of the exception that proves the rule about never to debate IDs, because sometimes it does work in our favor.
Right. Well, I mean, I've actually I've had that discussion with Eugenie Scott and with others, and I think the observation was based a lot on experience with Dwayne Gish, who was more of a classic creationist, not an ideer. And he was a very experienced debater. He had what we came to call the Gish Gallop, where he would just throw out so many misconceptions that you never could possibly address all of them.
Right.
But, you know, what Eugenie said, which I, through subsequent observation, I agree with, is that if you are going to debate creationists, and that includes intelligent design supporters, it has to be in a controlled environment. It can't be an open-ended debate. Because in an open-ended debate, they can generate more misconceptions than you could possibly deal with. You have to have some control over the scope and the content of the debate. Somebody, a moderator, asking specific questions, the ability to ask, you know, rebuttal questions. In that format, in that controlled format, you absolutely can get the better of them.
This was controlled.
Yeah, right.
So it was good. It was quite good.
Yeah, I'm sure if Eugenie Scott were there, I'm sure that she, having spoken to her about this, I'm sure that that's the way it was. So that's great.
Yeah.
Was it taped? Was it recorded?
I have a very crude tape of it myself. I'm not sure. It was webcast, so it might be available.
Oh, it should be.
Yeah, it's called The Great Debate. It's at BU. It happened, when was it? A couple of weeks ago. I can get you the date later.
I'd like to listen to it.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
Bob and I met Demsky in, I think it was that New Mexico?
No, it was L.A.
It was L.A., that's right. It was L.A. It was at the last PsyCop World Conference. He's a real jerk, that guy. You know, on a personal note, He's you know, I did not like him. There were other, you know, creationist ideas there who were very nice people.
Who was the other guy, Steve? He was a nice
Nelson.
Guy.
Nelson was
He was a nice guy. He talked with us. He met with all of us later, and we were like, you know, 100-1 against him, and still he had a good,
good
attitude and good humor. The other guy was just
Demsky
so dour.
Scowled his way through
so
that conference.
So dour. Oh.
Yeah, there's some scholars on our side.
That's
true. To say.
Yeah, it's true. I mean,
true.
If you're going to have a public debate, you have to have more than on your side than just being right is not enough. I think so many scientists have gotten into trouble because they say, hey, you know, these creationists are idiots. We're right. I have all these, you know, scientific facts on my side. With no prep or experience, I can go up against these guys. And they get crushed just because they have no idea what, you know, when you get hit with such subtle logical fallacies, sort of logical fallacies and arguments that have evolved over decades, not to be right, but to be subtle.
Yeah.
And if you don't know off the top of your tip of your tongue, you know, if you don't know automatically exactly how to hone in on what's wrong and what their response is likely to be, you'll just be jabbering and you'll come off like an idiot.
It's like playing chess, these openings and moves and counter moves.
Yeah, right.
And you're right, you have to be a good chess player to
come
out on top.
You have to argue them three moves ahead.
Yes.
You do.
Yes.
You absolutely have to.
Right.
I personally, of all the people on our side that I've heard, I think Kenneth Miller is the best.
He was good. Remember the presentation he gave?
He was great. I mean, he has all the skill sets that you need there. He has the detailed scientific knowledge, where he can pull the perfect example out of his repertoire as needed. But in addition, he knows all the logic, he knows all the arguments, and he's very smooth in public. So far, he's the best person that I've heard debate the ideas of the creationists.
The funny thing is, he's a theist, of course.
Right, right. He is a theist, which makes it even more interesting. He's Catholic, I think, right?
Yeah.
So he gets trotted out a lot because he's like, look, it's a scientist who also believes in God, and just basically to counter the argument that they're incompatible. Which I think it is important to counter that, regardless of the scientific argument. If the creationists will win the hearts and minds of the public if step one is you have to reject God to accept evolution. We won't even get up. They won't even listen to us. We won't even get on deck.
The funny thing is, his book, Fighting Darwin's God, is, I thought, terribly, terribly flawed. I mean, precisely because he is a theist. He ultimately ends up trying to defend something that a good skeptic would immediately see through right away.
Right.
And he gets into quantum mechanics and has a long section on free will. It all boils down to the fact that we have to be free. God gave us this freedom, and this is the bottom line, which he cannot question. So it's interesting. However good a debater he is on this limited turf of refuting intelligent design, as unfortunately he doesn't go all the way. Well, how could he? He's a theist, and theists are limited. They have to be limited in their skepticism, it seems to me. Although the most sophisticated ones will deny that. They'll say, no, I ask just the same questions as you do, and I still come down on the side of God. And that's, of course, where you get into your Plantingas and your really rarefied theologians who have, some pretty impressive arguments going. I don't think they win the day, but they can get very, very rarefied and very sophisticated in their defenses. However, Ken Miller is not one of them.
So, Tom, let's turn now to the topic of free will, and I think you have a sense that perhaps this is the most controversial extension of your naturalism philosophy, the idea that that people do not have free will. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, we have to, of course, be very clear about what we mean when we talk about free will. I think a sort of a metaphysically uncontroversial way to define free will is simply to say, I do what I want to do. I make my decisions. What I do is up to me. Now, that's uncontroversial in that, if I am getting married and I sign my the wedding certificate, whatever it is, in front of the Justice of the Peace, and they ask, did you sign this of your own free will? I say, sure. No one is forcing me to do it. So that's clear. But when I do something of my own free will, who is the me that's acting? That's when we have to get metaphysical. And that's where we have a choice between a supernaturalistic idea of the self and a naturalistic idea of the self, because it makes a huge difference when we think about human agency and freedom. So there are two types of freedom on offer, I think, that one having to do with a naturalistic view of ourselves and one with a supernaturalistic view. The naturalistic idea of freedom is simply the idea that I act freely when I act voluntarily without being coerced or compelled to act in a way that I don't want to act.
Right.
I'm in my right mind, and I act freely in that sense. No one's forcing me. But on a supernaturalistic understanding of the self, there's something besides the physical person, the body, and the brain, all of which, on a naturalistic understanding of ourselves, are probably completely determined, completely caused phenomena, just like the rest of nature. On the supernaturalistic idea of ourselves, there's something like a soul or a spirit or some kind of mental agent that has the power, this very interesting metaphysical power, to choose or act without being fully caused in its choices or in its actions. In fact, the self, according to this idea, might even have to be self-caused in some way. It owes, in some part of it, owes nothing to what came before it or what surrounds it. So this very strong metaphysical free will is, I think, at the heart of many people's, not everyone's, but most people think of themselves as as what Daniel Dennett calls a soul pearl, sitting inside the head somewhere, something immaterial, it's not the brain, but something.
The ghost in the machine.
The ghost, exactly. Right, the ghost in the machine is another way to put it, as Gilbert Ryle originally said. And it's this kind of freedom, this kind of free will, contra-causal free will, that I think is, as you said, one of the more controversial implications, the denial of that is the, one of the more controversial implications of naturalism. It's to really to have to make our peace with the idea that we're fully natural physical creatures, and that all our behavior, in fact, all the words and thoughts that we're thinking right now are arising out of a sufficient set of causes such that if we replay the tape, say, 5 minutes ago with all conditions set the same words and thoughts would be arising as they are right now.
Right.
So this is a very, you know, many people find it a very depressing, fatalistic, a meaning-depriving scenario where people stop being dignified, free human agents, and that where choices somehow disappear. Of course, I want to deny that. I don't think those implications follow. But that's kind of the some of the objections that arise, that we can't hold people morally responsible unless they have this kind of special freedom. Of course, but we can hold people responsible. Anyway, I don't want to anticipate all the objections that come up. There's quite a litany of them. But really, the contra-causal free will that I'm objecting to is it really flows quite directly from the supernaturalistic faith-based way of understanding ourselves. Mm-hmm. Whereas if to get back to our first segment, if you stick with empiricism and science and as your way of knowing about ourselves, then you'll be led to deny this kind of freedom. And of course, this is not a new insight. This goes back to the Buddha, who was, you know, really an empiricist, although in a religious guise, and David Hume and Diderot and La Mettrie and Bernard Dolbach and David Hume. Einstein denied free will. I've even learned recently that President Lincoln was a free will skeptic, believe it or not. So there are many free will skeptics over the centuries, and we're simply rediscovering this truth about ourselves most recently in the context of neuroscience, where we see that the brain does everything that the soul was supposed to do.
That's right, and I think, you know, again, I'm a practicing neurologist, so I have some direct clinical experience with this, and it's definitely true that the natural assumption that people make is that, you know, certainly that we are free will agents, that our personality is this sort of immaterial construct, and it's very disconcerting when people really have the realization that everything that we think of as our personality, ourselves, our sense of self, is a phenomenon of our brain, of the way our brain is wired together, of electrons moving through neurons and axons.
And I know.
it comes to very, very stark reality when one of the subsystems in that brain breaks down. You have a stroke, you have a tumor, a bleed, or whatever, some neurological malady occurs, one of those subsystems breaks down, and it's what's fascinating is that the entire construct changes in a way that you really can't conceive of unless you think you're thinking of the mind as a physical construct. You know what I mean? So, like, if the language area is damaged, people lose, you know, the ability to put together language. They may, in fact, also lose the concept of language. The neglect syndromes, I think, are the most profound. For example, you may not be able to perceive one half of the world, of the universe. And it's not a visual problem. It's a conceptual problem. You can't even think about it. And you can't even notice that something is wrong. You don't have the capacity to even know that it's abnormal or there's something missing about the fact that you can't conceive of half of the, like the left half, for example, of the world.
Right. Yeah, most people are very uncomfortable with the physicalist idea of the person.
Right.
They just the way they want there to be a God. They want there to be something more inside them. It's sort of there's a parallel between the big God up there and the little God of free will, as Bob Miller, who I work with at the center, talks about it. So we have big God and little God, and the little God of free will it plays all the same roles that God, the big God, plays in our own lives. So in a way, we are very much made in God's image, according to the mythology of the self.
Right.
It's an interesting point. I'm just wondering how your other skeptics down there feel about this, because I know, however skeptical people are, and you probably are extremely skeptical, and rightly so, about most things. I'm just wondering if the skeptics that you know or that are online with us now would buy this.
My personal experience, they generally do, but it may just be a matter of them understanding the full implications of the neurobiology.
Right.
I think a lot of times they just didn't think about it. They were never really directly confronted the idea of, you know, what is the mind. And it's one thing to sort of have an intellectual grasp that, yep, we're physical beings, our brains are physical, you know, we're our brains. But to fully appreciate the degree to which everything we think of as ourselves and the outside universe is really just an illusion, a construct of our brains create, really as an epiphenomenon, as a way of just dealing with, you know, the world, our environment, that it's a fascinating and sometimes uncomfortable realization. But the skeptics that I know haven't objected to it on metaphysical grounds or anything like that.
So you think that the skeptical community might be or is fairly open to this way of understanding ourselves?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I haven't encountered, because I talk about this a lot, again, from my neurological background, and I usually encounter, you know, fascinated interest, not rejection.
Good. Well, that's most encouraging. The other thing that the center is doing is not only to promote this naturalistic view of the self, but it's also to talk about the consequences, the sort of ethical and practical implications of getting rid of the freely willing agent, the contra-causal freely willing agent, to get rid of the soul and the ghost in the machine. Because once you do that, then you see yourself and other people in quite a different way, I think, than we ordinarily take ourselves. In that when we assign blame or credit, often we have in the back of our minds the idea that someone could have done something other than what they did in a particular situation.
Mm-hmm.
That they weren't fully cause, or if they were fully cause, there's something about the self that's ultimately in charge and therefore takes ultimate responsibility, ultimate credit and blame. And when we see ourselves in a fully naturalistic way, without contra-causal free will, what happens? Well, we understand that there, but for circumstances, go I when we look at the homeless person on the street, or the addict, or the criminal, or the rich person, anyone. There's no causally privileged soul that's different between people. It's all a matter of the luck of the draw, your environment and genetics. They shape you in their entirety. And so that puts a very different cast, very different light on our responsibility practices, on how we give ourselves credit and how we blame people, will become, I think, what I've seen, the implication for me anyway, and many other people who've taken this in, is a reduction in being, say, morally superior or mm-hmm. blaming or arrogant or contemptuous. Of course, it doesn't mean that we still don't make moral judgments about people. That stays the same. But it's our reactive attitudes, as philosophers call them, that are second-guessed in the light of a thoroughgoing naturalism about the self and free will.
Right. I mean, it certainly would argue for being understanding and compassionate, or at least to take a, you know, neurobiological/sociological approach to understanding human behavior rather than a high-handed moralistic approach.
Exactly.
But I agree with, I think, what you were saying also, is that, well, we still have to run our civilization, run our society, as if we do have free will. In other
words... Well, what would that mean exactly? When you say, as if we had free will, what do you really
mean, though?
Well, I think
the free will, not in the metaphysical sense, but in the sense that, like you said before, you choose to marry somebody, it is your free will choice to do so. You're not being compelled or being forced to do so. We still do make choices. Even though those choices may be determined by the prior causality, if you organize society in such a way that people are not responsible to some degree for the choices that we make, you could imagine that might not be a viable civilization, right?
Sure. No, I agree. It's just when you say we still have to treat each other as if we had free will, what a lot of people will interpret you as saying is that we're still allowed to punish people punitively without regard to the fact that they're fully caused to behave the way that they do.
Right.
Therefore, we don't have to look at the causes of behavior. We can ignore them. That, for many people, would be what it would mean to treat someone as if they had free will, as if they were uncaused in some respect.
Right.
And what you really mean, and I agree with you, is that we have to have still have to have responsibility practices and accountability
right.
practices that maintain social order. But, of course, those practices will and should, on my view, change significantly precisely because we know that people are fully caused. That leads to compassion, as you said. Moreover, knowing how they're caused makes us much more effective in prevention and treatment, in designing a non-punitive, humane culture. So I think there are tremendous implications to this deconstruction of the soul. And more people are getting hit to this, as you mentioned off tape. Before we get started, Steven Pinker, a psychologist now at Harvard, wrote a terrific book called The Blank Slate, although it's controversial in some respects. But he's got a whole chapter called The Fear of Determinism, where he takes on the myth of the ghost of the machine.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is that this part of the book has gotten absolutely no press at all. There's a conspiracy of silence about this issue, which the center is trying to break. There's a taboo, as Alan Watts, I don't know if you guys remember Alan Watts, back in the 60s, a East-West philosopher bringing the wisdom of the East to the West. And he said, the title of his book was The Taboo Against Knowing Who You Are. And that indeed is what we're up against. There's a taboo against talking about this issue, because everyone thinks that if to do so is to open Pandora's box. Whereas if you look at it carefully and clearly, you'll see that the fears that people have of letting go of free will in this contra-causal sense are really unfounded. But that that takes a bit of doing. It takes a bit of explaining as to how we can hold people responsible. Why, as you said earlier, choices still make a difference. You know, we still are agents.
I think Steven Pink. I read The Blank Slate. I highly recommend it. It's an excellent book.
Yeah.
And he made the point that what he's saying is not saying that we don't make choices. He says, try to go a week without making a choice, and you'll understand the fallacy of saying that. We still make choices. We're still, agents in that we have choice. It's just that those choices are caused. They're caused by our psychology, the way our neurons are hooked up together, the way we our internal and external experiences, et cetera, and that, we can understand what leads people to choices, by understanding the internal and external influences upon them, in sort of a judgment-neutral context. Although, I would emphasize, just to be clear, I mean, you're not saying that people shouldn't go to jail for committing crimes.
No, but what I am saying is that jails could be a lot nicer, and we have to think about rehabilitation at least as much as we think about deterrence.
Right.
And look at the wider context of criminality so that we do a lot more in terms of prevention.
But do you think that deterrence, you wouldn't rule out deterrence through punishment, or would you?
Well, this is a tough question. And a lot of people who are naturalists and free will skeptics like I am have taken on deterrence, too, because they really, like Bruce Waller in his books, and Dirk Pirboom at the University of Vermont, written a book called Living Without Free Will, published about 4 years ago, and the last two chapters are about the criminal justice system. And he doesn't really put much stock or believe that we should deter particularly. We should instead concentrate our attention more on what he calls sort of quarantine, in other words, a non-punitive detention, and then look to social redesign to do what deterrence otherwise would. Of course, though, realistically, we need fines. We need to keep people in line.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole deterrence paradigm is another step that we can take towards a non-punitive culture. But the first step, though, is to get rid of retribution.
Mm-hmm.
There's no good grounds for punishing people when it doesn't do any good at all except to inflict suffering. And a lot of people, even free will skeptics, haven't gotten there yet. So that's something that we have to take
right.
on.
And of course, you know, the Pinker and others would argue that that's because we're hardwired to desire retribution. That's
right. But
one
that
of the
of course
things
that
makes people people.
Right, but of course that doesn't mean that it's right.
Of course, and again, yeah. that was coupled with the argument that, you know, as a civilization, with insight, some sort of self-insight, we need to transcend some of the motivations that evolution has written into our genes. Things, there are some behaviors that may have served an evolutionary purpose, but in modern society are actually counterproductive. And,
exactly.
And if we understand them, it could help us overcome and transcend them and sort of this desire for revenge, if you will, for retribution. It may be one of those things that is ultimately counterproductive.
And Tinker himself has made considerable progress in his understanding of free will. Back in the book The Language Instinct, or some one of those books early on, he talked about the necessity of holding on to the free will, the fiction of free will, as sort of as a social convention.
Right.
And said we still have to continue to treat each other as if we had free will. And he's come around in The Blank Slate and other writings to the view that we discuss now, which is maybe we don't even need the retributive model anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe deterrence is enough, and of course then we can go on and question deterrence as well. So the Pinker has made progress, which is great. And I also want to just say that there are many people, or at least a significant number of people now writing about this very issue. Paul Bloom, a Yale psychologist, has written a book called Descartes' Baby, where he talks about this dualistic understanding of ourselves. Owen Flanagan, a philosopher and cognitive scientist at Duke University, has written a terrific book called The Problem of the Soul, which really takes the view that the center is espousing. And I have to, full disclosure, he's on our board of advisors. and as is Thomas Metzinger, who's written a wonderful book. He's a neurophilosopher called Being No One, the self-model theory of subjectivity, Being No One. Terrific book, a difficult one, but which challenges from a neuroscientific perspective and a philosophical perspective this whole myth of the soul in a very rigorous fashion, I should say. So my point basically is that there are a lot of people challenging the soul and free will out there, Dan Dennett, Steven Pinker, Flanagan, a lot of whom I talk about at naturalism.org.
Mm-hmm. Let me bring up one more topic that comes up frequently and I think has served to sow a great deal of confusion within the public, and that is quantum mechanics. Now, we hear this frequently in many paranormal claims, ESP and many forms of spirituality. Astrologers now are jumping on this bandwagon. The idea that the implications of quantum mechanics are such that the world is not deterministic is one claim that is made. The other one is that different parts of the world, even parts of reality of the universe that are isolated from each other in a Newtonian model, but based upon quantum mechanics, we're all sort of intimately connected on the quantum level. So that could explain why the position of stars light years away could influence your personality, for example, an astrologer has argued to me.
Mm-hmm.
So is that something that you hear frequently as maybe an objection to your deterministic model of behavior?
Yeah, it comes up all the time, the idea that there might be some random or indeterministic element that isn't subject to causality. But there's a difficulty here for people who raise this as a defense of free will, or any kind of free will worth wanting, as Dan Dennett puts it. The difficulty is that if there were some part, some influence on me that was random or non-deterministic, that would mean that my character was not determining the behavior either.
Right.
In other words, what I want in free will is for my behavior to flow from my character and my desires and my motives. Otherwise, it isn't my behavior, right?
Right.
It isn't my choice. So we want determinism in that case. We don't want anything random intervening between me and my behavior. So the question then is, where does indeterminism or randomness get you? What kind of freedom does it allow you? Well, the only kind of freedom it would give you is if your character weren't fully caused to be the way it is. But that would mean that you wouldn't be deterministically constructing your own character either, so you couldn't take responsibility for your character,
mm-hmm.
because it would be something indeterministic that was causing it to be the way it was. So the upshot is that indeterminism and randomness, whether it's quantum mechanical or anything else, doesn't do anything to give us a kind of free will for which we can take credit or blame. So the truth of determinism is not at issue. I don't have to be a determinist, although it's very likely, I think, that we are fully determined creatures at the macro level of human behavior. There's no reason to suppose we aren't. And the quantum effects probably wash out at
right.
the higher levels that we're at. But even if there were that kind of indeterminism, it wouldn't give us the kind of causally privileged authorship that people really want from this kind of contra-causal free will. So determinism, it can be true or false. Hume saw this long ago. It's called Hume's fork. If we're caused, we don't have free will. If we're uncaused, we don't have free will.
Mm-hmm.
I think, anyway, that's what's Hume. There might be other definitions of Hume's fork, but I've heard that being one of them. So that's the usual.
Yeah, and Tom made the point at the end there, but it's a lot of the assertions that these people make, they just stem from a fundamental understanding of theories like quantum mechanics. I mean, the things that they're saying are, you know, things are truly like that, but they're at the microscopic level. I mean, they wash
out. The sub-microscopic level, at
right,
the atomic level.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, at that level, you've got things like indeterminacy and quantum entanglement and things like that. But as you scale up, I mean, you pass a certain point where they all wash out, they decohere, and those things don't exist in the macroscopic world. End of story, right there. I mean, that's just it. You're not going to communicate, through entanglement to some atom 10 light years away instantaneously. I mean, you're not going to, things like that just don't happen in the macroscopic world. And that, to me, that's the main failing of a lot of these assertions is that they're talking, you know, the submicroscopic world and we don't live in that world. We live in the macroscopic world, and that's why we don't see those bizarre counterintuitive events in our daily lives.
Well, Tom, I hate to say this, but we're out of time already. That went by very quickly. Any parting thoughts?
Well, first of all, I appreciate the opportunity to be on the show with you guys, and more power to what you're doing.
Thank you for being on.
Carry the torch of skepticism, and I hope that from time to time, as skeptics, you'll be skeptical and raise the skeptical question about the soul, about contra-causal free will, and then get into the consequences. Because I think, frankly, this is the next big step for free thinkers, skeptics, atheists, and humanists, is to take on a full-blown, thoroughgoing naturalism, which has all these, I think, very positive implications, both for ourselves personally and for the wider culture.
Great. Well, Tom, it was a pleasure. Again, Tom Clark is the editor and founder of naturalism.org. Pay it a visit. There's a lot of great articles there. Tom, thanks for being on The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Thank you, Tom.
Well, thank you, guys.
Thank you, Tom.
Bob Perry-Evan, thanks again for joining me.
Thank you, Steve.
My pleasure.
Until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is a production of the New England Skeptical Society. For more information about this and other episodes, visit our website at www.thenes.com. Theorem is performed by Kenno and is used with permission.
Last theorem, let him far from the mainstream. Sleepless nights, slow burn days, problems, proofs, endless.